This is Bernard Stonehouse, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 7th of February 2012. Bernard Stonehouse, Part 3.
We left you at the end of your first tour of duty in the Antarctic. You came back to Britain, 1950, was it, Bernard?
Yes, early 1950, about March, I think, 1950.
Was that the end of your Antarctic adventure from your point of view?
No, I knew I wanted to go back. I'd left the Navy, or they'd put me on the reserve, and I decided I wanted to be a zoologist and then go back and work in the Antarctic again. So my brother-in-law, Freddie Marshall, who'd been with, who'd been at Hope Bay, and was a fisheries biologist at the British Museum in London, applied on my behalf while I was on the way home to join University College in London, which I did. Almost as soon as I got back, I went up for interview there, and they took me on the strength of my a record in the Antarctic. I'm very glad, because I wouldn't have been able to pass the entrance exams that they were holding at the time. I had to look at some of the question papers and so on. I was way out. Anyhow, they very kindly took me on, and so I enrolled from that October to read zoology. It was special honours and geology as a subsidiary. So that's what I did. Now, I had some work to do at the British Museum with the collections that I'd brought home, and that gave me opportunity to think out what I wanted to do afterwards. And what I really, I thought I would probably get involved with penguins again, because it was Emperor Penguins who were helping me to get into that, into the university, and they were what I knew all about. And I was more likely to continue working on those than just to become, let's say, a fisheries biologist or something like that. So I was pretty well oriented from the moment that I got into the university. And as the 3-year course proceeded, I didn't have much opportunity to think further about what I'd already done. But I went up to Oxford for a course, a vacation course at the Edward Gray Institute, run by David Lack, who was a distinguished ornithologist, who wrote, among other things, Life of the Robin. I think he was probably best known for that, although he'd also done some very good work on the Galapagos Islands and so on. And he'd been up to the Arctic when he was an undergraduate. And one way and another, this fitted in very well, because I gave a short paper at that conference on the breeding biology of the emperor penguin. Anyhow, I read the paper at the conference, and he was very surprised that anybody had done more work on emperor penguins, because he hadn't heard about it. And he said, "Well, obviously, if you're going to, you need to write it up for a start." And I said, "Oh, well, the Colonial Office had told me not to write it up because they wanted somebody else to go down and do the emperor penguins properly and so on." And he said, "No, that's absolute nonsense. You need to write it. Now sit down and write what you know, and we'll get a note into Nature, and then we'll think about report." And that was some very, very positive thinking, which I think made me realise that I really was on to a very good thing here. And he also said, "Now, when you finish your degree at London, if you're going into research, you'll want to take a doctorate." And he said, I tell you now, I would welcome you here if we could arrange for you to do some further field work on penguins." So, of course, that clinched it. And then I began to look around. And I talked to Bunny Fuchs, who was by then running the, who was now director of Fred's, and said, I want to go back to the Antarctic. He said, yes, that's absolutely fine. I said, well, I think I want to, I'm being advised by David Lack. And he said, well, if you know something about emperor penguins, you won't get back to the emperor penguins now, because the base had closed, of course. But why don't you work on the king penguins on South Georgia? So that's how I lined up South Georgia. And as soon as I'd graduated, I was enrolled at Oxford for my DPhil. They do a DPhil. A year and a half's field work on South Georgia. We had a bit of a problem with the Oxford University regulations, because they specified that anybody doing a doctorate based on Oxford had to work within, I think it was within 3 miles of the Carfax, which is the crossroads in the middle of Oxford. So we had to write to the examinations board or whoever it was and say, well, we didn't think there were enough king penguins within 3 miles of the Carfax to justify a study. And they wrote back very thoughtfully and said, yes, well, we agree, and in the circumstances, we'll be happy for you to work in South Georgia. So do let us know what how it works out. So then in my sort of finals year, I had to I had to work out a plan for two of us, myself and Nigel Bonner, who was a colleague on the course, a contemporary, who wasn't sure what he wanted to do. So I said, well, why don't you come to South Georgia with me? I'm going to need an assistant, and you can study seals or reindeer or whatever you want to do. So I lined him up as well. So then we had a two-man expedition to go and work on king penguins. So that was all lined up. So when I took finals, all I then had to do was sort out the logistics of getting the two of us down there and being able to live there and so on.
So the answer to the which came first, the penguin or the egg question, you were going south not to go to the Antarctic, you were going south to study penguins who happened to live in the Antarctic.
Yes, that's right.
So it wasn't the Antarctic that was calling you, it was the penguins?
It was the penguins, yes. Well, as David Lack pointed out, look, you're the only one who knows anything about this genus of penguins, the kings and emperors. Nobody's worked on the kings. We know they do something funny about their breeding cycle because they have chicks there all the year round. Well, now, why is it that emperors, you've got two problems. Why do emperors breed in the middle of the winter? But why do kings, who are the next size down, keep their chicks all through the winter? Either seem absolutely crazy, and we want to know more about them. Well, I'd part solved the problem of the emperors. They're big birds. The eggs take twice as long to incubate as any of the smaller penguins, and the chicks grow very slowly. So if you want to launch your chicks in the spring, then you have to lay the eggs at the beginning of the winter and incubate them through the winter. If you're going to do that, what's the economic way of doing it? Well, instead of having both sexes running backwards and forwards across 40 miles of sea ice, you exhaust a sex by doing the 2 months incubation, and then at the right moment the other ones come back, the females come back, loaded up with food, and then chicks are away to a very good start. And then by the time the chicks are really needing more and more food, the sea ice is breaking back. So it all fits. It made sense of what seemed to be a very odd sort of breeding cycle. Well, now, The kings were obviously having part of the same problem, in that they too are big birds, and so they would have to think of something. They would have had to have thought up something that suited them. Now, what are the details there? And so it was quite clearly a very nice problem in which I had a very good start. So we... while I was doing my 3 years in the zoology department, I'd also... I was keeping up my flying because the Korean War was around, and anyhow, I wanted to... I liked flying and I wanted to continue, so I joined the... I had my commission transferred from the Navy to the... from the Naval Reserve to the RAF, VR, and was able to do weekend flying with the University of London Air Squadron. So I was able to keep up. It took a lot of weekends, and every Thursday evening, I think, we had ground school studies and so on. But I was doing that at the same time as I was taking my degree, and that was very nice. It also gave me some extra money, and I was able to run a car on the strength of it, because I was getting flying pay. I was getting officer's pay plus flying pay per diem, which was very convenient. Anyhow, then I did 18 months in South George. We worked with the whalers. The whalers were the only people there who were doing anything at all active, so I got in with Salvesons. This was all arranged for me by the Colonial Office and so on. I had to buy all the stores and equipment. Well, we got grants for that and so on. And I was employed by the government of the Falkland Islands to do a survey, not by Finns, but the government of the Falkland Islands, to do a survey of the King Penguins on South Georgia. And that, of course, included the breeding behaviour and the development, which was going to be my study for my doctorate.
Just before we talk about what you discovered about the King Penguins, tell me about Nigel Bonner. What sort of chap was he?
Nigel Bonner, yes. Well, he was an interesting student. He'd done national service, so he was a bit older than the rest, and he'd done it in the army. And I think he'd been a very good officer, a cadet, and then a young officer for the 2 years he was in, and he might almost have stayed in the army because I think it would have suited him very well. He was good company. He was always good company, and he came with me. He didn't get stuck in the way that I was able to, because he had to spend more time finding his feet. And he started off very badly by contracting appendicitis on the last day of the voyage down to South Georgia. So instead of being able to come out with me immediately to the Bay of Isles, where we were going to set up our camp, he had to spend about a month in bed at the whaling station at Leith Harbour. It was a very bad case. He was very fortunate. If we'd had another day at sea, I think he'd have died of it. We got him ashore just in time to have a very much an emergency operation. Thank God there were doctors there who knew what to do about it. But he was still on the sick list for the best part of a month.
So the operation took place at Gritviken?
At Leith Harbour.
Leith Harbour.
Which is where we were going.
And was it a hospital situation, or was it?
Yes. As I say, fortunately, they had a good small sort of cottage hospital set up there, and were able to do something about it. But it wasn't a simple operation. It wasn't a simple job at all. So he was an invalid for, I think, best part of a month, and I had to get an assistant from the meteorological station there, somebody who was able to come out with me to build a hut and get the stores organised and so on.
Did Nigel display any of the promise that he later fulfilled?
No, he didn't, which was rather surprising. He was very intrigued with it, and he obviously loved it. I think he missed civilization in a way that I didn't, because I'd done all that before. He couldn't really get down to it, but I suggested one or two things he could do in Penguin and so on. Well, he wasn't very interested in that. He was very interested in nerves and the anatomy of nervous systems and things like that, which, of course, he couldn't do anything at all about in a 10 by 14 hut in the Antarctic. But eventually I got him interested in the reindeer, and we got him interested in the seals, and he was able to do some work on those, enough to justify his later coming back to South George as a sealing inspector. Mm-hmm. And it was in that trip that I think he became a dedicated polar biologist that he later was. You might say the foundations were laid when he was there as my assistant for a year and a half. But then when I think later he realised he'd missed a lot of opportunities, so he came back and was taken on as a government inspector. And then from that, I think he got in with Dick Laws and so on, to do his work on seals. He never took a doctorate. He published quite a lot of papers and so on, but he never got down to a detailed study of any one corner of biology that I think would have, which might not have been a very good thing for him anyway, because he became much more general biologist and eventually was, I think, as far as I know, did a very competent job as the head honcho at Bass.
What about this so-called garden shed you found yourself spending your 18 months in? Tell me about that. You seem to have an affinity for garden sheds.
Well, I think that's where it started. I said, what sort of? I had to sit down and think out what sort of accommodation do we need, and I thought, well, something like a wooden hut, 10 by 14, with reinforced. We're going to have to overwinter in it, and South Georgia wasn't as cold as the Antarctic had been, but we still needed something very strong and stable, and that could be insulated. So. I had a look at the back of the Radio Times, and there was a Halls, I think it was, the firm that was advertising garden sheds at, I don't know, about £100. You could buy a 10 by 14 garden shed. So I had a look at one of those and said, yes, that'll do. Can you fit me double windows? Supply some timber that we can make internal partitions and things like that, and the benches and the furnishings that we're going to need. And I knew what sort of a kerosene stove we would need for it. We weren't going to have anything more elaborate than that. And it served us very well. We needed some heavy timbers for the base plate, but we got those from the old whaling station, the Prince Olaf whaling station. We went and paid them a visit. And
was it double skin, the walls?
No, it was just a tongue and groove timber, and we lined it with we took down some lining material, it wasn't asbestos, it was some sort of a plastic or furry material, and we lined it with that, and then plywood. So we had a wall, we had a good insulated wall about 3 inches thick. And that did. Now, if I were doing it again, I'd want to put a porch on it, so you didn't open, it didn't open to the wide world. I'd have wanted a better door rather than the sort of panel, the rather poor panel doors that they supplied. We took some corrugated iron that we got from one of the old whaling stations and some timber from that. We built a store shed just a distance away, so that if they had caught fire, we'd have somewhere to go into, and all our stores were there. And we had a radio that only worked very intermittently to keep in touch with the whaling station. And we quite owned a couple of little generators, just to generate enough power to give us our battery lighting in the evening or in the long winter nights or something. And it was perfectly adequate and very, very cheap.
How did you stop it from blowing away?
Anchored it down in the way that I'd seen Antarctic huts anchored. Anchored down, you put ropes over and attached to a box of rocks at either end. We had no problem with that. And it's stood up perfectly well for the time we wanted it. I think it was eventually burnt down by the by one of the other expeditions that came along. And I'm told they had a part in it and they set it on fire. It was certainly burnt out when I eventually got back to seeing it.
And the equipment you had inside for your scientific work, was that elaborate or...?
No, very simple. I was doing observation and I was collecting embryos and I was collecting some bits and pieces, of pituitary glands and things like that for... because we had an idea that might, those might tell us something about the about when the birds came into breeding condition and so on, but that was all a sideline. Nigel, I think, if he'd had a laboratory there, he'd have got down to his studies of nervous systems and so on, which I think he would have liked. But of course, there was never any question of that. We didn't have the money and we didn't have the motivation for it anyway. So it was very simple. Some weighing equipment, measuring equipment, boards to write our notes on. No computers running like that, of course. It was way before that time. But
not even clockwork ones.
I had a complete Encyclopaedia Britannica, which I bought at the door while I was a student in London. I thought we'd take that now; it might save one or two arguments. And had quite a good small library, just a few yards of a shelf with a selection of books on. We had visits from the whalers during the whaling season, which was all but about 4 months of the year. They came once in the middle of the winter when they were going round fixing buoys or something like that, and they called in to see us. We had an incentive for them to come and see us because we had the only free supply of whiskey on the island. I didn't have much, but we'd been told that if we wanted to get special treatment from the whalers, that would be a very good thing to have.
So tell me about the science then that you did. What did you? In what way were you able to further the knowledge of the breeding patterns of king penguins?
Well, I went out every day. We marked a number of birds. We painted numbers on the shirt fronts, which is the obvious way to mark a penguin of any kind.
With ordinary paint?
Yes, Well, we had several different kinds of paint we tried out. The sort of rubberized paint, which was best because that would stand several months of going back to sea and things like that. And I took aluminium bands for the flippers to identify them positively that way, and we simply. We found a small colony. I was careful not to use one of the big colonies, but the whalers, I told me, where there was a colony of about 2,000 birds, which was smaller, in the Bay of Isles. And as soon as I saw it, I said, yes, that's right. This is the right sort of setup. We can have the hut here. There's an old sea cliff along the back that provided shelter and some fresh water from the a glacial stream flowing right past the door and so on. We had to chase some of the elephant seals away because they were using the beach as a resting. No fur seals at that time, of course. In the whole 18 months we were there, we saw one fur seal. So they were just starting their extraordinary recovery. And I must have marked altogether, I would think I had a population of about 200 birds marked. And I followed them through the season, and the pattern gradually emerged. I went down every day to the colony and just wandered around it. They got used to having me around, and I was able to pick up the numbers. I had all the numbers that I had were on a board, and I ticked off the ones I saw and what they were doing and that sort of thing, and that went on day after day after day after day. And you gradually worked out what individual birds were actually doing, how they were getting involved. And when they molted, when they came up for breeding, you could weigh and measure them. Some of them got quite used to being weighed. All you had to do was put a sling around them and just lift them off the ground on a spring balance. You could do that with them still holding on to their egg. They got very blasé about it.
So penguins could fly.
Well, they couldn't, poor. But they. And every day was very slightly different. We saw the season through. That's very important for. I've always regarded that as very important for anybody who is trying to understand what polar regions are about as far as animals are concerned. You have to be there all the way through at least one season. Even if they're animals that don't do anything at all in the winter except hang around and wait for the spring, you want to know how they're hanging around and what they're doing while they're hanging around. I was very fortunate there. I'd already had the 3 years further south, and now I had 18 months, which was one winter and two summers, the summer at either end. And that gave me a very good understanding of what the biology was about all the way through a complete cycle.
Well, the thing that puzzles me, if I've got my facts right, is you unravelled the fact that they were able to raise two chicks in 3 years. Mm. And you did this having only been there 18 months.
Well,
how's that possible?
You saw they did very little after September. And then you started seeing the birds that were quite clearly not raising chicks. And the chicks were there and so on. So you had a population of birds who were raising chicks. And you had some of those marked, and you knew when they stopped raising their chicks, which would be about October. You saw them come back 3 weeks later, all ready for molting. They'd molt for 3 weeks or to a month, go away to sea, come back again, fattened up because now the sea was full of a plankton for them, and then they'd start breeding. So you knew what they'd been doing for the last 12 months, essentially, because previously they'd been raising the chicks. Now they were starting again. But they couldn't do this within a year. The chick that they had just finished with must have been laid as an egg in about January. But by now it was March. They'd started laying again in March, which meant that they couldn't fit one chick into 1 year. Yes. So now you could follow them through the next. Well, now about half of them lost their chick in the or their egg in the normal or the chick in the normal course of events. So then they would go back to scratch. They would go back to start again as early breeders in the following October. The ones that succeeded would have to start again after this. So they could get two ticks in 3 years, but they couldn't get three ticks in 3 years. And many of them, of course, didn't get the two ticks in 3 years because they lost a tick, and they had to start again. So they would, and so on. This was how you worked it out. They don't have time to fit one chick rearing into the calendar year. Of course, all the little ones can do that, standing on the heads. The emperors do it by setting back into the incubation during the period when there isn't really anything else to do at all, and so on.
So as a consequence, in any colony, there'll be chicks of all ages simultaneously?
Mm.
Yeah.
There are chicks in the colony all through the year.
Yeah.
All through the year. This is what puzzled people who in the past who'd visited the colonies and said, well, in fact, they thought these brown penguins were a different species. They called them woolly penguins. And they're identified as that. Because in the middle of the winter, the colony consists of 2,000 chicks and about three adults. Because all the adults are away. And then the adults come back only about once in 3 weeks. Each adult will come back and pick out its chick from this mob and feed it and then push off again. And they're only around for 2 or 3 days and then they go off again. And then the other parent would come back, say, 3 weeks after that. So the chicks were only fed.
How was your research received in academic circles?
Well, I got back and was now back at Oxford and wrote it up and somehow managed to write a history of Antarctic exploration while I was doing all this.
And get married.
Well, it was only published in Dutch eventually. The English publisher had dropped out, but he'd sold the rights to a Dutch firm, so it was published only in Dutch, and I don't think. I may have a copy of it around, I wanted. It was David Lack, I think, who pointed out to me: if you want to know something about something, write a book about it. Because if you're going to write a book about it, you have to. And it's easier to do it that way because you've got a purpose for learning and a direction to go in. And I've very often use that. But I wrote my thesis and it was examined by two very good examiners and accepted. And then it was published as a Fids report, and as my Emperor Penguin had been, and that was fine. I was.
Was it that established you as a bona fide?
Yes. Well, then I was still at the Edward Grey Institute in Oxford. I'd written up, and I was kept on as a what do they call them? As a demonstrator, which is a sort of trainee lecturer, if you like. And then the British Ornithologists' Union, which is the oldest established ornithological union in the country, and probably in the world, was having its centenary year. And they planned two expeditions. And I was approached through David Lack and so on. I was part of the grapevine then to see if I would lead it. I think they're impressed with the garden sheds. I guess. If you do work at the garden shed, so I thought of the Arctic and so on. But the one of the major issues in biology at that time, in bird biology particularly, was what controls breeding seasons. What are the environmental stimuli that get birds started in breeding? And I think it must have been David Lack pointed out, well, now there's a problem on the equator. Would you be interested in He said, we're beginning to realise that where the seasonality, it's day length that's controlling, through pituitary glands and so on, it's controlling the breeding season. But what happens where there's no seasonality is on the equator? So I'd look for localities on the equator, and I wanted to work on seabirds because I like the sea and I like being on islands and so on. So we found Ascension Island. There's a very interesting problem there because there was a population of terns that was breeding on average every 9.4 months. How the hell do terns decide that they're going? Now there were known to be a dozen other species there, which is enough to make a nice little population. So I said, well, why don't we go to Ascension Island and do some work there and find out what these breeding cycles are? I'm very good now at working out. I know how to start working out breeding cycles. Let's go and work there at least keep warm. I just got married to Sally, so she was able to come with us. And so we set up the British Ornithologists Union Centenary Expedition to Ascension Island, which again was an 18 months thing to be able to cover the whole of a year and then a bit at either end. And I think it was that really sort of got me launched as a
that require more than one garden shed.
We had three. We had two garden sheds, and then we were able to build more from the debris that the Americans had left on Ascension Island during the war. But that's another story, and it's not polar, so you probably won't want to know too much about it.
All right,
but it was great fun.
Yeah, okay.
And it got me away from the Antarctic into another field altogether.
So at that point, did you suspect that your Antarctic days were over?
No, because then along came George Knox from New Zealand, the University of Canterbury. And he was in Britain looking for a biologist who would be polar, would be able to take up a senior lectureship straight away in the university, in his university, University of Canterbury, and start a polar operation for his zoology department. He would be interested to do it himself, but hadn't time because he was running the department. But he wanted somebody of status, let's say, who could come along and get University of Canterbury involved in Antarctic work. Of course, I fitted the bill absolutely. Yeah. Now I was keen to go to New Zealand because I'd served with New Zealanders during the war. In my squadron there'd been several New Zealanders, and I was very impressed with them. They were my sort of age, but way ahead of Brits in independence and freedom of the way they thought and things like that. So I was very keen to go to New Zealand. He was very keen to have me, so we went off to New Zealand. And the main advantage was that Operation Deep Freeze was working out of Christchurch. So right on my doorstep, I had a bunch of Americans who were only too happy to take New Zealanders down to McMurdo Sound.
And that's how you wound up at McMurdo, is it?
That's how we got involved with that. Now, I was there for 8 years, and for each of the first 5 years, I ran our biological expert. I set up a biology unit which would go down to the Antarctic and work in McMurdo Sound, working out of Scott Base. Because at that moment, the New Zealand government wanted to get the universities involved. So far, they'd succeeded only in getting Victoria University of Wellington to send a small geological party. They went down every year. Well, I said, right, well, if they can go and do geology, I can go and do biology. And so we decided we couldn't work in with them because they were doing other things and doing it in their way. But I went down with a unit of four, I think it was, in the first year, and we had a very quick look around and homed in on Cape Royds, where there was a daily penguin colony. It's the southernmost daily penguin colony in the world, where numbers were known to be declining because a biologist from Canterbury, who wasn't able to continue his work there, but had spent a season there and said, well, the colony is much smaller than it had been in Shackleton's time. And he was afraid that it was declining. So he said, right, we're going to concentrate on Cape Royds. We're going to set up there. We actually lived in Shackleton's hut for two seasons, which was not the right thing to do at all, but of course it was then. The New Zealand Antarctic Society had sent volunteers down to clean it out, get all the ice out of it, and then they were looking for people who would actually live in the hut, because they were getting a lot of American visitors helicoptering in. All the American VIPs wanted to go and visit them. So they were quite happy to have a little unit working in there, and that's what we did. So I started marking the penguins, individuals, to get to know them, and marking their nests and so on. You can do that with the dailies because they make nests. And it's quite a big area of a colony, but only little patches of it were being used. So it was quite clearly declined very recently. Well, it didn't take us long to identify why. It was because these helicopters were flying in, landing on the lake. It is in the middle, right alongside the hut, so the VIPs could get out and walk into the hut, have a look at it. American VIPs were congressmen, journalists, senators, army people, and so on, who were taken down to the McMurdo base by the Americans, the journalists particularly, so they'd write the good things at the papers and get more money for the National Science Foundation to continue the work. But on the whole, they couldn't care less about the Antarctic. They were just there to do the job. And they were... you land a helicopter in the middle of a penguin colony and the penguins get bowled off their nests. And I had photographs of that actually happening. So we said, well, look, this is nothing ecological. It's nothing about, as far as we can see, it's nothing about plankton supplies or anything like that. It's simply the mechanics of this being a... These were some of the first tourists in Antarctica, you see. Yeah, this was before tourism as such actually started. And I had very interesting encounters. I reported to the New Zealand government that this was happening, but they couldn't do anything. They didn't feel they could do anything about it because it was the early days of the Antarctic Treaty. Now, they claim the Ross dependency. Americans didn't admit that claim. But nobody wanted to quarrel about it. But the New Zealand government didn't want to appear to be bossing the Americans around. So they said, well, we're not going to approach the Americans about this. So I went from the university in Christchurch down to the American base in Christchurch, made an appointment to see the admiral who was in charge of it, who turned out to be a very good chap indeed. And I said, look, your pilots are blowing the penguins off the colony now. You don't want that happening, do you? And he said, no, I don't. And I said, right, well, I'm a pilot. I can draw up flying regulations for the colony, which will land them about half a mile up the hill. They can fly right around, you keep right away from the colony, land on a... we'll mark out a pad half... And he said, well, that's a problem, because most of the VIPs are not capable of walking half a mile up or down, up or down. But he said, we'll try it out. You draw up some regulations, give them to me, I'll sort them out, and I'll see that they take account of them. And they did, and it worked. And from that moment, the colony started increasing again. I was able to follow it for another 4 years, and we were getting very good, very positive. I mean, it was very simple, but very clear.
You were using your piloting skills to determine how many penguins there were in a particular colony at one point, weren't you?
Yes, I got on to that. The Americans had a very good setup down at McMurdo. They had dozens of their own American scientists coming in from American universities and so on. They were very keen to help the New Zealand units to get their work done. And if you knew what they wanted, what you wanted, they would help you. Several of the pilots said to me at different times, well, you're easy to deal with because you know what you want. Most of our chaps coming down don't. And it's not surprising, because I hadn't been there before. I hadn't, and knew what I wanted. And we worked out that Adélie penguin colonies, there's a time about 3 weeks into the breeding season when all the nests have the eggs in, and each nest has just one bird sitting on it, and the other one's away at sea, and they're very highly synchronised. And that is the time to take a photograph from the air, because every dot is a nest, is an active nest. And we worked that out, and they were flying DC-3s at the time, which I was quite familiar with. And you took the side off, and you put your camera over the side, and you kept it to about 5,000 feet so that you weren't disturbing the birds. But if you had a decent camera, you could get a very, very good series of photographs. We used colour photographs because the definition was better, and you throw them up onto a screen, and you can count them. Of course, there are much better ways of doing it now, but this one. So we, as it were, pioneered that technique of counting penguin colonies from the air. At the same time, I was able to fly all around the place, and we found, I think, there was 4 more emperor penguin colonies in that area that nobody knew about or hadn't been reported. And there were all sorts of other useful things like that that we were able to do during that 5 years when I was taking our students, I was taking part as a student down, 3 and 4 students at the time.
We're still very much in the early days of scientific exploration in the Antarctic, but you were already getting concerned about the impact the scientists themselves were having upon the continent they were studying.
Well, yes, those VIPs, I think I read an article, for New Scientist or for one of the journals, saying too many tourists in the Antarctic with a query after it. And of course, tourists then were the sort of visiting parties, the VIPs and so on. And I also pointed out that they were doing these big operations, the operations run by the military on behalf of science, playing hell with the environment. I mean, the rubbish dump outside McMurdo Sound was enormous. they put all the rubbish out on the ice in the hope that the ice would go out. But of course, it doesn't go out every year in McMurdo Sound, as we know darn well. And eventually, when about 4 years had accumulated, it had grounded the ice. So even when the rest of the ice went out, that didn't, because it was. And the turning point there was one of the first cruises by genuine tourists coming down. It was run by Lars Erik Lindblad, who was the sort of pioneer of Antarctic tourism, who was a very responsible chap himself, did taking parties to all sorts of places all over the world. But he was dealing with wealthy people who he could train very easily not to kick the place to pieces. Well, a small party came down to the Antarctic. It was the first tourist cruise to go into McMurdo. And I met them at a reception later on. And one good lady I met, an elderly lady, said, "Are you the young man who's protecting those penguins at Cape Royds?" And I said, "Well, yes." I was in my 40s, but she must have been in her 80s. And she said, "Well, are you still having trouble with the Admiral?" And I said, "No, Admiral and I, just like that, we're getting things sorted." She said, "Well, if you have any trouble from him, let me know, because I play bridge back in Washington with his mother. And if she thinks that he's giving penguins a hard time, she will make his life hell." And that was when I realised that here was a whole constituency of people coming down to the Antarctic. They were not coming down to gain seniority in the services. They were not coming down to get their PhDs. They were coming down because they were curious about the Antarctic and they wanted to do something. Once they got there, they bought it. And they wanted to do something to help it. And it was, and I didn't follow it up then, but later on in life, when I come back to Britain and was getting back into Antarctic research, I got a message from one of the cruise companies. Would I like to go down as a lecturer on the ships? Now, at that time, that was not a popular thing to do among scientists, but I remembered this group, and I thought, yes, this is an opportunity to get find out what's actually happening here. I'd heard the industry was building up a bit. Okay, well, I was invited to get involved in it, and I did. I'm very glad I did because it opened up a whole new research field for me.
You were initially anti or at least sceptical of the idea of...
I was very sceptical of the idea of anybody going to the Antarctic who wasn't actually doing some science. Useful scientific work there, and that included all the support, all the...
So first of all, why were you so anti, and secondly, how come you changed tune?
Well, I realised that the cruise ships were being run on what I call the laws, what I call the Lindblad pattern, which was first and always to protect the environment. A, it sold tickets. I mean, this is why it worked. It was for fairly wealthy, privileged people who, even if they wanted to kick the place up to pieces, wouldn't have done so. And generally, they didn't. They were all involved at home in the Audubon Society or this society or that society or the other for protecting the environment, and they were when it came to the Antarctic. So... And anyhow, Americans are much better trained in this sort of thing than we are. Smokey the Bear and that sort of thing. They have all these marvellous natural history reserves of one kind or another. They were brought up on this. And so they were very easy to train when you got them down to the Antarctic. And when I started lecturing to them, I realised they were very, very interested indeed. And they were also influential. Because like my good lady who knew the Admiral's, her mother, they would all have environmental interests when they got back home. And somebody said, oh, well, they became ambassadors for Antarctica. Well, I think that's overstating it slightly, but it's in the right direction. And now they were beginning to come down in the hundreds and then in the thousands. And they were not leaving any mess or any... I mean, if there was a mess in the Antarctic, it wasn't tourists who were doing it. It was the scientists who were there 20 years ago and had finished and abandoned it, or it was the aviators who'd left 40-gallon drums there that had now rotted away. Everybody else was mucking up the Antarctic, but the tourists weren't. And once you accepted this, then you realise that really there was a lot to be said for a certain amount of tourism in the Antarctic.
Well, that's a key fact, isn't it? That's a key phrase, a certain amount.
Well,
would you want to put a ceiling on it?
The conclusion that I came to was that the Antarctic Treaty simply was not able to cope with this, was not... First of all, it wasn't willing to, because they thought the Antarctic... they thought that Antarctic tourism was a flash in the pan, it wasn't going to continue. I knew better than that after about 5 years, because I realised that these were very popular cruises, and the number of ships was increasing every year. The prices were going down because they were cutting costs in various ways, and they were getting very cheap. Russian ships had come down for practically peanuts. Some of those were an absolute menace because they didn't have the right charts and things like that. But that was something you could do something about. They had a very good trade organisation called IATO, which more or less helped to set up some of the rules that they set for the industry. And it paid everybody in the industry to join IATO and get the privileges that you got from being a member of IATO. That's the International Association of... International Antarctica Tours Operator. International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, which were doing a very good job. They were bothering to do this when the Antarctic Treaty was simply not into it at all. So I was getting all the support I needed from the industry to get around, because I could lecture on board the ships, and in return they would take my parties and put them down where we wanted to be, and then... pick him up again after a few months of observations and so on. The tours operators knew that I wasn't a tourist. I wasn't necessarily pro-tourist, but I was sharing all the information we got, and if I saw something going wrong, I pointed it out. I set up guidelines for some of the popular areas, which I gave to the government, but they took no notice whatever. But I gave it to the tourist operators, and within a year or two, you'd find it was in all the guidelines that they put for their own lecturers on board the ships.
The process that you described, is getting to the Antarctic at all, was always an elitist elitist operation. You had to have either...
It's expensive.
A particular scientific interest, or as a tourist, lots of money.
Mm.
The ships got bigger, the prices came down, the ships got dodgier, some of the Russian ones, more people came. If that trend continued, would you start to get worried? Because...
Well, I had to get to know quite a lot about industry and how industry... And this is why I was interested, because it was... Mm. It was broadening my interest the whole of the time. You had to try to sit down and work out how an industry of this kind worked. Well, I talked it over with the operators, and I talked a lot to the ship's captains, because I was able to help them on the bridge by saying, look, there's an interesting... If you're looking for something to do, there's an interesting penguin colony over there, and I know you can land people there, because... I could be useful, and at the same time I could be learning a hell of a lot. And so a lot of this accumulated around me, if you like.
The point I'm making, though, is that, I mean, in the 19th century, getting to Venice was very difficult. So Venice wasn't threatened. In the 21st century, anybody can go. It's under threat. And the same process is possible. It's possible the same process maybe begin to undermine the pristine nature of the Antarctic, isn't it?
Well... Right up to the last 3 or 4 years, the graph of numbers of ships and tourists going was going up like that. Mm. And right up to the last few years, there's no reason why I shouldn't continue doing that. Now, the Antarctic Treaty has absolutely no control over this. The industry was driven entirely by its own profitability.
Yeah.
And more ships were coming in.
Now, David Attenborough's films making people want to go.
Well, of course. That and the Geographical Magazine, and National Geographical Magazine and so on. Everything was pointing to this increasing, and nothing was holding it down. Now, the Antarctic Treaty can't stop tourism. It can't control tourism. So there's absolutely no way it can. It can cooperate with the tourist operators, and occasionally it can put the boot in, as it has done recently with the big ships, by saying, well, if you're burning thick oil, you can't go beyond either that distance north or that distance south. And that's been accepted as a general proposition all over the world, and it's affecting the tourist industry, and some of the big ships have had to stop going down there, and they don't go there anymore. It's a pity because, in fact, the big ships are, in a sense, some of the safest ships that can go down because they don't take any risks. They always go down the middle of the channel. They don't go into odd corners. They're very well equipped for navigation and things like that, far better than some of the smaller ones. They always have at least one and possibly two ice pilots on board who know the area like the back of their hand. They often have people like me on board who also know the area like the backs of our hands. And between us on the bridge, they're about as safe as any ship could possibly be anywhere. This is possibly not the time to be talking about the safety of big ships, what's happened in the Mediterranean, but for Christ's sake, you don't get people like that in the Antarctic. They're some of the safest, and I think probably they're some of the, ecologically, they're some of the best anyway, because they take so many passengers for in one unit. I mean, you can take 4,000 passengers on one big ship, or you can take 400 passengers on 10 ships, each of 10 ships. Now, which is better ecologically? You can argue along. You can argue along those.
Well, on the other hand, if a small ship gets into difficulties and needs to be assisted, getting 100 people off a ship is easier than getting 4,000 people.
Well, it's always the small ships that are getting in. Now that some of them do get into trouble, it's the small ships that are getting into trouble. The answer to that we proposed as soon as it came up: if you're sending one big ship down, for Christ's sake, make certain that there's another big ship within steaming distance of it, because that's your safety valve. Mm. If you've got 4,000 passengers on a sinking ship, you need a bloody great ship alongside to take them on board, because you can't get them all on board.
On the Zodiac.
You've got a big problem, but it's a much smaller problem if you have another big ship alongside or within steaming distance. About 20 hours would be fairly critical.
In your guiding years, in your years as a tour guide on the ships, the knowledgeable level of the public, was it improving all the time?
Always very mixed. There's some people who didn't know where they were from one day to another. They were on a big ship, and I remember one lady, a very wealthy lady on one of the big ships, and she said, I said, how long did you spend cruising every year? Oh, about 10 months of the year. She said, well, where'd you go? She said, well, I don't mind. It's the ship that's important. It's my home. every day, I'm living in a wonderful hotel. It's moving around, so I have different scenery every day. Service is wonderful. I'm not going to get mugged. I've hundreds of different people to talk to. I can come and talk to you. I can go and talk to the chief officer. I can go and talk to the cook if I want to. It's an ideal. Now, she wouldn't care whether she was in the Antarctic or in Florida. She wouldn't mind which she was in. Others, and I would say the majority, are so thrilled to be in the Antarctic because of Admiral Byrd, of course. This is the generation that was brought up when Admiral Byrd was very much in vogue. I've had dozens of elderly men come up to me and say, well, when I was a school kid, Admiral Byrd came to our school and he patted me on the head and he said, one day, son, you've got to go to the Antarctic. He said, that's why I'm here today. That's exactly why I'm here today. It's in their background in the way that Scott and Shackleton are in our background. And then you get a ship with 400 Japanese on board. You can't do a darn thing with those because they have their own translators and so on, and their own guides who are absolutely hopeless. They don't know anything about the Antarctic at all. All they want to do is take photographs. Well, in a sense, those are some of the safest people of all, because that's all they want to do. They don't want to hold a penguin. They don't want to collect rocks. They don't want to leave litter. They don't even want to go ashore. They just want to take photographs. They take a photograph of themselves with the mountain in the background, photograph of themselves with the ship in the background, and then they go home. Now, they've not done the slightest harm to Antarctica, so millions of those could come down without taking it out. No, the industry is much less of a menace than the scientific industry was in the past. It isn't now because it's much better controlled. And anyhow, it's getting so expensive that... now, that's... At the time the tourist industry was coming up, I think the scientific industry is, if anything, going down. What I don't like is the fact that nobody is controlling the numbers of ships except the economic circumstances. And if the numbers are down now compared with 4 or 5 years ago, it's because of external situation, not because we've reached some sort of a plateau that has something to do with the ecology of Antarctica and its protection. Now, I would like to see that. I would like to see somebody sit down and think, now, what are the implications if in 10 years' time we have twice as many ships going down as we have now? Is it safer? Some would say yes, because the more ships you have, the more safety factors you have. Two or three ships are going around the Antarctic on their own, a bloody menace. But if you've got 30 or 40 all within reach of each other, you have a sort of a self-support or self-maintaining community. But let's not pretend that the Antarctic Treaty is able to do anything about this in any way. Okay.
Let's pause for a second. I need to change the tape. Thank you.